Last week, three professional storm chasers died in an Oklahoma tornado that was over 2.5 miles wide. This hour, the value and risks of storm chasing. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. One of the storm chasers who died was a friend of Iowa State University storm expert Bill Gallus. We'll talk with Gallus about the science of storm chasing and how the deaths have affected his passion for tornadoes.
I'm still fascinated by them, but part of me just kind of has lost the desire to see one for a while.
Before that, quick looks at some Iowa news this week, Iowa City's ban on drones and red light cameras, and thoughts from a teacher on education reform. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last week, three professional storm chasers died in an Oklahoma tornado. It was a record-setting tornado over 2.5 miles wide, if you can imagine that. Later this hour, the value and risks of storm chasing. I'll talk with Iowa State University storm expert Bill Gallus. Bill Gallus was a friend of one of the storm chasers who died, Tim Samaras. First, though, we want to quickly roll through a number of developments in news here in Iowa for comment, starting off with education reform. A few days ago, Governor Branstad signed into law House File 215, and he touted the education reform as historic. He said it was painful to see Iowa slip to the middle of the pack in terms of comparisons with other states, and pledged it will usher in, quote, sweeping education reform that will ultimately return Iowa schools to a national leader. Joining us to talk for a few minutes about that in our Cedar Falls studio, Ann Lebo, a secondary dean and English teacher at the Grundy Center Community Schools, also a board member at the Board of Educational Examiners. Ann, thanks for taking the time to come into our studio.
Thank you for having me.
Remind us, what do you see as the most significant reforms made by this new law?
I think the most significant portion is that the ability to change a student's life is really being fully invested back into the hands of the teachers, or I should say into the hands of the teachers. We know that they're our most direct line of changing students' lives and affecting their learning, and now we're giving them the opportunity to collaborate, to highlight their talents. You know, we're showing teachers in the state of Iowa that we are investing in you. We know you have so much to offer, and we want to allow you the opportunities to collaborate and share those talents with each other. Mm-hmm. And I think that that will really change.
In specifics, as far as the components of the bill, what we've talked about again and again is allowing some of the top teachers to take on a more instructional leadership responsibility to mentor. How will that work?
Well, and I'm not sure that top teachers are necessarily the accurate term. It's teachers that have different talents that can be utilized in different ways within a school. So maybe there's some teachers that have excel in different areas, whether it's working directly with students or working with other staffs. This now gives them the opportunity to step outside of their classroom to share that talent. So we know right now a lot of teachers are kind of locked in their rooms most of the day, and there isn't that natural opportunity to collaborate. We might have professional development times outside of school hours. This gives them the freedom to work with other staff during the school day when really their resources and talents are most needed. In addition, it provides funding to both teachers and schools to allow for this to happen. So it recognizes their talents mm-hmm. by an investment in time and some financial recognition for what they have to offer the school system.
Mm-hmm. Also, a funding to increase the minimum starting teacher's pay to $33,500, is that right?
Yes, that's correct. Initially we proposed some higher salary recommendations, but I think this was something that was a compromise, and we'll show teachers, though, that we really are interested in changing what the profession looks like and inviting maybe different teachers or different people who would maybe not originally considered it by offering some additional incentives to mm-hmm. support themselves financially. You know, we're certainly moving in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. So Iowa is one of the lower paid, the states that pays lower wages to salaries to teachers?
It is on the lower end. I think it's moving its way up more towards the middle, and hopefully this will continue to raise us more towards the top. But it is by no means a leader, and we used to be a significant leader in what we offered for our teachers and for our students. So hopefully this is going to change some of that as well.
Yeah, of course, Iowa always touted as I was growing up as one of the best places to be educated in the country. What are you hearing about this package of reforms from the teachers you work with, the educators there in the Grundy Center Community Schools? People talking about a new era, or are there some people saying, I don't know?
I think most of the teachers that I've talked about this, and I've talked to teachers outside of my own district, once they understand what it really is and the potential it offers for teachers, you know, one gentleman, he's like, you know, I've been in education for over 30 years. He goes, this is the best thing I've heard in that whole time. So I think when they understand the opportunity it provides, I think they realize that it's a great opportunity. I think there's some, the only hesitation I've heard is when there's maybe some misunderstanding, people don't really know what it is, and there's that fear of change. But those that have heard it and been able to really look at it and think about what this really offers have all been very enthusiastic.
Okay, we'll keep our eyes trained on the front of the classroom to see how this develops. So an email from Jessica Gogarty to throw in here at the end of our conversation, and she's a teacher and school improvement leader at Roosevelt High School in Des Moines. She writes, historically, in order to advance one's career in education, one must leave the classroom. Typically, the higher a school teacher goes in the hierarchy, the further the leader is removed from the classroom. But the classroom is where school improvement occurs. We must develop and value classroom leadership by giving our teacher leaders the responsibility and resources, not to mention the recognition and pay, to be drivers of school improvement. She goes on, this new law sets in place the structure to do just that. I'm very optimistic that our state will see huge, genuine gains in student achievement if we implement this law with fidelity, because we have such excellent teachers in our state. If we can harness their energy and empower them, we'll go places. So the implementation will be a question mark that we'll just wait for, huh?
Yeah, and I think if we continue to be very proactive and continue to share what we know, I think we can really ensure that the implementation will be what is intended to be. And once teachers can kind of get their hands involved with this more, they're going to realize that it's kind of unlimited what we can do in terms of changing learning for our students.
Mm-hmm. And this is not phased in? Is this all coming to effect this fall?
No, there will be a year of sort of preparation. Schools have the option to be in, well, it's optional. First of all, schools don't have to participate. And then your involvement was sort of gradual, where you would have money is contingent upon what level of involvement you're at, where you have a year to sort of prepare, and then there's full implementation. So there is a transitional year for preparation, but again, it is not required for any schools to participate. But we certainly would hope that when schools recognize the opportunity that provides, that all of them will consider participating in it.
Ann Lebo, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Ann Lebo of Grundy Center Schools, Community Schools, thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, catching up on a few developments, comments on a few developments in the news this week. And joining me now to talk briefly about a few issues involving civil liberties in our news this week, Ben Stone. He is the Iowa Executive Director of the Iowa ACLU. Ben Stone in our Des Moines studio. Welcome back to the program, Ben.
Good to be with you, Ben. Thanks.
Right off the bat, we have to have your comment, of course, on the big news that's hit us in the last few hours, the National Security Agency's surveillance programs dominating the news in the last 48 hours. We just heard President Obama in our news saying, you know, it doesn't work that you have 100% security and 100% privacy. Your take on these revelations?
Well, first of all, that's a false choice. You know, nobody's asking for 100% of anything. We just want a good country that's got privacy and safety, and that can certainly be done. But it's not, we're not doing it the way we should. I think what we're seeing here is something that was entirely predicted by the ACLU and other critics, you know, back 8-10 years ago, that when you create a surveillance mechanism that has absolutely no accountability, that does not involve any serious judicial role, that doesn't have any kind of transparency, even
But there are a panel of judges involved in these decisions 24/7 is the report, isn't it?
Yeah, the FISA court is a court in name only. I think what we're seeing here is that, first of all, it's all in secret. There's no way for people in this democracy to have any knowledge. You know, in fact, one of the things that's interesting, Ben, is that Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act, so-called, is a provision that allows for the government to get records. And the government refuses to actually explain the legal analysis of what the law means.
Mm-hmm. But to give you a little pushback, to be effective, If we would know the details, if this was not kept secret, then of course potential terrorists would know about it too, which would defeat the purpose, right?
Well, I don't think the terrorists would be benefited by a legal analysis. And, you know, frankly, the simple fact is that there's a lot that could be done that would help the American people understand what the government is doing on their behalf that we're not hearing. I mean, they're just doing 100% shutdown. Mm-hmm. Lawsuits are shut down by the courts. Any effort to get records, you know, the simple fact is that they're doing things that they could explain, but they don't want to explain them because they know the American people will have a very hard time feeling good about it.
Okay.
And,
well,
you know, I think that's what they need to realize.
What do you hope will come from this, that the administration will act differently in the coming weeks?
I think what's going to happen is that there just seems to be leaks coming, whistleblowing of sorts on an almost daily basis. I think that there's been a recognition by professionals in the government that what's happening is really inconsistent with American values, and we're going to see an increasing release of information, and I think that's going to force the hands of Congress to and the media, the press, to really start reporting on this. And, you know, it can be done without giving away all these secrets. There's a great overemphasis on total secrecy being necessary. You can redact things. You can be very careful about what you release, but they can sure give us a heck of a lot more than they're giving us right now.
Ben Stone of the ACLU of Iowa, the executive director. Let's closely related to this on a local scale, though. Iowa City will be among the first municipalities in the country to adopt a ban on drones and other surveillance devices. City leaders in Iowa City making it clear they hope the ordinance isn't permanent. This happened on Tuesday, the Iowa City Council unanimously approving the first reading of this ordinance to ban drones, automated traffic cameras, license plate readers, after thousands of local residents signed a petition calling for such a ban. So is Iowa City going to be a trendsetter not only for Iowa but for the country here?
Well, I think that's an interesting possibility. One thing that's really kind of intriguing about Iowa City's situation is that Iowa City is actually the only city in the state that has this petition ordinance in their city charter. So there isn't going to be a trend of cities adopting local ordinances based upon petitions. Now, certainly local governments can just decline to purchase and use traffic cameras and can set up ways of not having drones. But in terms of the petition process, you know, people know that, you know, Oregon, California, hear about all these, you know, petitions and ballot measures on the election ballot. Iowa doesn't have that, but the city of Iowa City has this. But on the broader scale, it really is, this is one of the first ordinances passed in the country that really forbids the use of drones. Now, drones are not widespread yet, but there is, as we've had on this program before, there's an industry out there that is investing tremendous amounts of money in lobbying the Congress to get grant money sent out into the states to help launch the purchase of these mechanized machines that go up in the sky and can look at things.
So paint a picture of your worst fears in this case, because perhaps people see maybe civilian drones as something that they don't have to worry about. What are you worried about?
Well, I think what anybody who is paying attention is worried about is the unregulation of this. You know, we need to have rules so that we have our privacy and our rights protected. And it's so hard with technology. Technology is moving so fast. And look at the Congress today. I mean, goodness, Congress can't do anything, let alone keep up with technology. So we really need the states and local municipalities to step up and represent the rights of people and say, look, you know, the ACLU does not believe that drones are never to be used. We just think that it's important that there be parameters placed on the use, you know, both by law enforcement and by private parties, that people really don't have to be concerned that there's going to be drones filling the sky. Because believe me, the companies that want to make money selling drones would love to see the skies of America filled with drones.
What about red light cameras? I think there are some exceptions in the Iowa City's approval to ban automated traffic cameras. Perhaps you know more about that. But why would automated traffic cameras be a problem for civil liberties?
Well, I think what we're finding is, you know, as people live under the in communities where traffic cameras are being used, particularly the red light cameras, they find that, you know, they like them initially because they think, well, you're going to get all those bad drivers over there. Get that bad driver off the road, the people that blow through the intersection very recklessly and dangerously that nobody wants on the road. But what we find is that in order for these traffic cameras, these red light cameras, to make money, they have to get a lot more than just the dangerous people. They want to get the people that make right-hand turns, that didn't stop behind the white line and make a right-hand turn on a red. That's where they make a lot of their money. Mm-hmm. And so I think what we're seeing is the ordinances, the ballot measures around the country, there's only been one time out of about 35 or 40 petitions or ballot measures where they've been upheld. People do not like these when they have a chance to vote on them, and I think that we're seeing that in Iowa City, even though they haven't even lived under them yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you say, though, to a family member of someone who is, let's just take this as a theoretical, a family member of someone who is hit by a car racing through a red light? As you mentioned, we know it's habitual for many drivers to step on the gas when they see yellow, to blow right through that red. Don't we have an obligation to correct that bad habit to prevent the loss and injury that results from it?
Well, the very best way to do that, Ben, is to adjust the yellow time so that it's longer, or to have all the lights red. This is engineering of traffic signals. It is a proven successful strategy. But what that ends up doing is it creates a great deal of safety benefit, but it also costs revenue. And so the best way to do it, and there's actually been cities around the country, not here in Iowa, but there have been cities caught actually extending shortening the length of the yellow time, the yellow light mm-hmm. time, in order to get more violations so they can make more money. It's been demonstrated. Hasn't happened in Iowa, and we hope it never does. But that's really what you want. You can make roads safer, but it sometimes comes at the expense of the bottom line of the cities, and that's what I think people are going to learn.
Ben Stone of the ACLU of Iowa. One more thing, a couple minutes is what we have to tackle this. It's a National American Civil Liberties Union study found that Iowa has the largest racial disparity in the country of arrests in marijuana possession, blacks being more than 8 times as likely to be arrested than whites, even though whites use marijuana about the same rate. Tell us more about this study. Why Iowa at the top of this list, or the bottom, I guess?
Well, for those people that have kind of followed the racial justice issue, this is not a real shocker. We know that Iowa has been one of the worst states in the country in terms of the disproportionate confinement of people of color. And this is just further evidence of that. It's really, it is a devastating report.
You would think, though, I mean, off the bat, you'd think that must be a state in the Deep South. Why Iowa?
Well, I think that it's it really does reveal that it doesn't take overt, you know, nasty racism to make things happen like this. Disparity happens when people are treated differently, and it really doesn't matter if there's, you know, racist motives behind it. I think, you know, people can understand this a little bit when you just realize that, you know, think about, you know, two young people. One kid is a white kid arrested in the, you know, caught in the suburbs with pot, mm-hmm. maybe, you know, in their parents' car, you know, their nice car in the suburbs, and then a kid in the inner city who's an African American kid who's caught on the street. The kids are often treated differently. You know, the kid out in the suburb may get sent home with mom and dad. You know, they've got a stable home life. They've got two parents at home. The kid in the city, you know, is likely going to go to juvenile. Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to get hurt at school. And I think what we see is the school to prison pipeline. And what the ACLU really thinks is important that people start considering really seriously is that the war on drugs has become, you know, half of the people arrested in this country for drug violations are arrested for pot. And pot possession. And there really needs to be a continuation of what we're seeing with this movement of people of Colorado and Washington. Let's consider legalization, because it is easier to get pot than it is to get alcohol if you're a young person. And yep. The reason that is because alcohol is heavily regulated. And we need to find a way to get it, because the communities of color, African Americans in this country and in this state, have been devastated by the war on drugs. And we need to put an end to it.
Ben Stone, Executive Director of the ACLU of Iowa, thank you for stepping into our studio and offering your views this Friday as we look back on the last few days of news. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Ben.
And finally, this half hour, before we get to talk about the risks and value of storm chasing, Iowa Public Radio's Sarah McCammon joins me. And Sarah, our host of Morning Edition, of course, and a reporter out there doing some things. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Ben.
Hey, we want to talk a little bit about a visit that you're taking, that you visited, actually, a medium security facility in Mount Pleasant. We'll look forward to that report. But tell us why you took this visit.
Well, this stems from the case a lot of people have probably followed in Dayton, Iowa, where the two girls were abducted on May 20th after getting off their school bus. The younger girl, the 12-year-old, did escape, and unfortunately, 15-year-old Kathleen Shepherd is still missing. If you've been paying attention to this story, you know that the man authorities believe kidnapped the girls, Michael Klunder, who later committed suicide. He was a convicted sex offender with a long criminal history, including kidnapping. He did go through sex offender treatment while in prison at Mount Pleasant, and that led me to wonder how that treatment works and how much confidence we can have that offenders who go through sex offender treatment will not come out and reoffend. Mm-hmm. So I've been talking with officials across state government, victims advocates, and then I made a visit to Mount Pleasant this week to actually meet with a group of offenders and their therapists.
Mm-hmm. And we'll be hearing plenty more sound from that, but I believe you have a quote, some sound from one of those interviewees that you had there.
Who is this? I met four offenders. They're all Caucasian males in their 20s and 30s, and three had been convicted of crimes against minors. They're all scheduled for release in the next several months. One of them, though, Travis, who's 34, they asked that we just use their first names, sexually abused two adult females. And here's what he said about the treatment process.
The hardest part of treatment for me and probably everybody else is being honest with yourself. And once you can become honest with yourself and take a look at your problems, it gets a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. Sarah, then you imagine you found a lot out about the treatment for sexual offenders.
Right. Travis and the others I met with and their counselors all talked about kind of focusing on what motivated their crimes and what some of the steps were that they could take when they get out to sort of break the cycle. For Travis, he said it was feelings of worthlessness. Drug and alcohol abuse were factors. But a lot of the counselors I've talked with stress that drugs and alcohol won't make you a sex offender. But for people who do, for whatever reason, have those tendencies, it can certainly complicate matters. I also heard a lot about sort of unpacking their childhoods and their past and sort of learning how to take responsibility for what they'd done. Mm-hmm. I heard a couple of them describe themselves as selfish and as really having to face up to the reality of the terrible crimes they've committed and figure out how not to do that going forward. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a process for involuntary commitment for offenders once they get out of prison who are deemed dangerous. That's a complicated process, and I won't go into all the details now, but I'll get into that more deeply as I continue reporting on this story.
Okay. Sarah McCammon, that's all the time we have for now. We'll look forward to your reporting, your visit to Mount Pleasant at a medium security facility. Thanks, Sarah. Nice talking to you.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll find out about the risks and value of storm chasing. If you remember last week, three professional storm chasers died in an Oklahoma tornado, a huge one, a record-setting one, over 2.5 miles wide. And next up, I'm going to be talking with Iowa State University storm expert Bill Gallus. He was a friend, a close friend of one of the storm chasers who died. He'll tell us about that friend, as well as the science of storm chasing when we return. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.